Liveline on RTE Radio 1 with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the Kia Exceed plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
1850 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Their names are Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark. You'll see them in a lot of newspapers today. You would have seen footage of them from a previous appearance in Cork Court yesterday. And there is an incredible article, two-page article in the Cork and the Irish Examiner today, which in great, great detail, much to the credit of the journalist Noel Baker involved, details the incredible actions and crimes of these two solicitors, husband and wife latterly, and who got away with it. And as a judge, Judge O'Donovan, in a very detailed judgment, and he's obviously been across the case, this is a very significant crime given the amount of organisation and the amount of money taken. The organisation involves setting up false IDs, giving the financial institutions the necessary paperwork to open accounts and follow up by opening accounts, paying money into accounts and then taking money out. Against the background of deceit, all these cases of deceit usually involved using the position and the scheme as a breach of trust. An elaborate, criminally purposed, dedicated scheme involving false IDs to open a multiplicity of bank and credit union accounts. They actually bought the IDs off, or took, we don't know how they got the IDs, of homeless people in Cork. But the list is almost, and 16 credit union accounts, 80 false bank accounts, 19 ATM cards. An incredible operation. And the question is, how come it took so long? Because they were struck off years ago by the Law Society. And as the judge points out, it is the work of the Bank of Ireland fraud unit that led to the revelations and to the case against these two individuals. And when you have a couple colluding in crime, read about couples in crime over the years, you're in a very, very, very tough situation in terms of catching them and how out of control they get. Annette Kinahan, Annette, you've read this article in the Irish Examiner by Noel Baker, and you have a particular interest, and you're deeply upset by what this couple did to homeless people.
I am. It gives a whole new meaning to "you're only a number," because that's all they needed from these unfortunates was their PPS number.
And then they used, we don't know if they...
their illicit business. They played on the most vulnerable in society, the invisible people, the homeless. Because most people walk past the homeless and they don't even notice them. But these two spanned a business completely on robbing the identity of these people and creating false identities. It beggars belief. And, like, these were people, you look at solicitors and you're dealing with solicitors and you give them all your information, mm-hmm. and they're in a position like doctors and the whole, you know, that you trust. These people had a position of trust and they weren't short of money. If they put the same amount of effort into doing the job that they qualified for, they could have made a very, very lucrative living.
Good point. But they're bank robbers.
They were, yeah. They were bank robbers in suits. They didn't need masks.
And one of them got 4 years, Keith Flynn.
Wigs, apparently.
Keith Flynn, they had offices in Dublin and in Cork, but Keith Flynn, yeah, he got 4 years. Apparently he's now the chef. According to the report yesterday, he's now the chef in the prison officers' canteen, no
which
less.
Which you refer to as grunt work that he'd done himself in a previous life.
Compared to solicitors' work, yeah.
Compared to solicitors, because it's all the pushing pens.
Lindsay Clark, a former Fine Gael candidate, she got 2 years in prison. Stay there, Annette, but I'll come back to you, Annette, if I can, in a minute. Okay. Why you were so upset about the use that this couple's use and abuse of homeless people for their ends, for their nefarious ends. Katrina Toomey is involved, as we all know, in the wonderful Cork Penny Dinners. Katrina, good afternoon. You've read, and I'm sure you're given where you're based, you were aware of this case. It's jaw-dropping what they were up to. What do you think of what these two were doing with people who were homeless?
well, you know, I suppose to take advantage of some of our most vulnerable, and in the cold, calculated manner in which they executed the crime, that figures, you know, belief. It was well thought out and with no thought at all to their victims, and they said it was purely for personal gain.
I want to get a better line, Katrina, because it's such an important case. And now, Kinahan, I'll try and get a better line there as well. But Noel Baker is the journalist, social affairs correspondent in the Irish Examiner, who's written this incredible article. I really recommend it to people in terms of investigative journalism and putting together and giving this case where there's a couple involved in crime, where they're colluding, you're into a serious area of getting away with it and watching each other's back. And you don't need me to go through all the names. Noel Baker. Noel, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, Joe.
This is jaw-dropping, Noel.
Yeah, it's an uncommon case. These don't come along too often. As people have mentioned already today, the level of intricacy and the level of detail in this was extraordinary, really. I suppose more than one person would have said to me that their knowledge, their professional knowledge, would have been of huge assistance to them. Just knowing the nuts and bolts, I guess, of how to maybe process information, how to use information. But let's face it, they were concocting false information. And your previous guests have already mentioned the fact that the PPS numbers were the one genuine element of this. Everything else, they were kind of the seeds that were planted, effectively. Okay. And everything else flourished from those 8 PPS numbers, which were acquired from people known to homeless services, people sleeping rough. And I mean, you know, my understanding is that €100 was offered and taken.
Good
and that was the PPS number. And one PPS number was used 10 times. So, I mean, they were in heavy rotation, obviously, because you don't end up with 60 fake identities and 80 different bank and credit union accounts without putting a lot of work into it. But, you know, that was the genesis, effectively, just those PPS numbers.
And have we any idea, Noel, did they, these two, Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark, did they approach homeless people on the street and say, give us your PPS number, here's €100?
From what I know of it, and obviously only they can really answer that question, from what I know of it, it was that simple, really, yes. You know, I mean, they had an office in Cork, they had an office in Dublin. And as we know, we've been in the midst of a homeless crisis now for however long you want to mention, really. So, I mean, I suppose it's a case of whether they struck up some kind of brief relationship with them in terms of, you know, saying hello to them every day or something like that, or whether it was as simple and brutalist kind of going up and saying, listen, can I have a chat with you? I simply don't know. But the fact is that they were able to get them. Now, from my inquiries for this piece, my understanding is that the Department of Social Protection is aware of what's gone on, and that I think they were certainly endeavouring to make contact with the individuals in question. They probably have done so at this stage. One would hope they have, and that what is rightfully theirs, which is their PPS number, has been returned to them. But I suppose it prompts a lot of questions as to, you know, how easy it is maybe to open a bank account, how easy it is to kind of use something that's genuine but doesn't belong to you and use it in a way for your own gain.
80 false banking. Many IDs did they have? Many different identities did they?
Oh, so you have to get the calculator out. But I mean, I think there was 41 full driving licences anyway, 21 full Irish. There was a couple of digital UK ones in there as well. You had 19 bank cards, 16 credit union cards, 4 passports. 2 of those, I think, were UK. 31 SIM cards for mobile phones. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, there was a huge amount of stuff there. And obviously, the element of it that's kind of vaguely wacky, I suppose, is that when they were actually withdrawing the money, whether it's from the ATM or maybe in branch, there was an element of disguise going on as well. So, you know, they don the wigs and go in or use the ATM. And, you know, my understanding is that if you were approaching this investigation from the outside and you were going, right, I know that person standing at that ATM machine, as seen on the CCTV footage, is not a real person. They're obviously in some kind of disguise there. You wouldn't really have been able to determine from the level of disguise they had who they really were. I think it was the case that the Garda investigation had been so comprehensive that they were able to kind of lock the two pieces of information together.
And the Bank of Ireland, the judge in the previous sitting, Judge O'Donovan, he was scathing about Allied Irish, but that the AIB, Ulster Bank, various credit unions. The one that spotted the criminality was only in the Bank of Ireland, and it seems the other banks had said, "Ah, we'll walk away and forget about our losses." But the Bank of Ireland, and there was one man in particular, Alan Boland, who's a hero. There's a number of heroes in this, but he's a hero in this story. He was in the Bank of Ireland fraud unit, and he spotted discrepancies.
Yeah, there was a pattern there. My understanding is that there was a spelling mistake on documentation that was common to six different Bank of Ireland accounts. And obviously that shouldn't really happen.
What do you mean, though?
God, it's 20 plus years since I opened a bank account and I've only got the one. But, like, I mean, if you open a bank account, you obviously have to bring in a lot of supporting information.
Okay, which they faked.
And my understanding is that one of the pieces of supporting information for that, whether it's a utility bill maybe or whether it's something like that, there was a common spelling mistake across those. I'm not exactly sure what the spelling mistake was. But
well done to Alan Boland for spotting that.
Yeah, and in fairness, my understanding is that there was a lot of legwork done as well to kind of bolster that and to copper fasten it through other ways that they would look at it, through IP data and listening back to phone calls and things like that. But I mean, yeah, like the other banks, by the time this was raised and passed on to the Gardaí, they were not aware. But then again, I suppose, you know, we criticise the banks quite a lot in this country. In the manner in which the money was withdrawn, there wasn't necessarily anything to flag up fraudulent activity. And that's one of the extremely clever elements, I suppose, if you want to put it that way, of what they were doing.
Because they were getting loans and they were paying back. They were making some monthly repayments. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I mean,
then they disappear.
If you went into a bank under a false pretense and under a false identity and you tried to get a loan for €100,000 or something, well, you would probably struggle. But when you open your bank account and you bring in supporting documentation, you look and present as a plausible individual and you say, "Can I have a 10 grand loan for a car or whatever?" Then, you know, chances are you may very well get that loan. So direct debits were set up then to service the repayments on the loan, and the direct debit would be paid once, mostly, maybe twice in a small number of cases, and then the direct debit stopped.
Yeah.
But of course, the person who was repaying the direct debit and to whom the loan had been given didn't really exist. So the money was effectively gone, but because some repayments had been made, my understanding is that a financial institution would kind of move that towards the bad debt area, rather than saying, well,
fraud,
what's going on here?
Fascinating. It was a full-time job for the two of them. And the thing is, as I said earlier, when two people collude in crime, you were into big crime, because two people colluding in crime is very, very unusual. A married couple colluding in crime like this is very unusual, and that's why they got away with it for so long. But they were struck off by the Law Society before this.
Well, in September 2017, that's when Bank of Ireland first tweaked that there was something peculiar going on with those accounts. And I mean, the Gardaí became involved then subsequently, but it was well into 2018 by the time they kind of executed a warrant and actually recovered evidence and so on. They had been suspended from practicing in late 2016.
Why?
Well, now this is a good question. If you look at the Law Society Gazette, they do give the outline of the breaches that were against them, and this is well into 2018 now. They were actually only struck off, I think, in October 2018. But, you know, it's to do with deficits in client accounts, transfer of money left in client accounts, you know, things like that. Unrelated, it has to be said, and it must be stressed, unrelated to anything that the Gardaí subsequently investigated. It did go before the High Court. My colleagues in the High Court reporting pool would have actually reported on this at the time. I think the judge at the time, when he heard this case, when he was striking them off, making the order, he referred to the practice as being chaotic. And, you know, I contacted the Law Society about this because, you know, there's absolutely no suggestion that the Law Society did anything wrong. But I suppose my understanding is also that the Gardaí at no point had any correspondence with the Law Society. And one might have assumed, given their professional background and the crimes that they were ultimately being investigated for, you might ponder, well, was there anything in the first instance that could maybe have hinted at what was to follow? But the Law Society gave me a very comprehensive response, and they said, look, we always discharge our duties in relation to any suspicious activity regarding solicitors. We always ensure that we make reports to the relevant authorities, whether it's on Garda Síochána or revenue.
They say, we just got a statement in, and you did brilliant work even going back to the Law Society Gazette. The Law Society tell us, Noel, that these they reported these two struck-off former solicitors to the Gardaí in April 2018.
Okay, well, there you go. I mean, I didn't know that, and I sent requests
well,
to
how
the Law
soon
Society
after,
last week.
How soon after they came on the Law Society's radar would that be? 2018?
2018, they would have been suspended in the late 2016. They would have if they reported it in 2018, that would have been before the disciplinary process within the Law Society in the summer of that year and ahead of when they were struck off later. But it would have been after Bank of Ireland had alerted the Gardaí in Cork to the issue. So maybe, you know, it's possible that Gardaí in Cork were leading the investigation and that they were investigating crimes that were primarily anchored around maybe where they were living in Cork City, and that the Law Society had made a report.
And Noel, were they known around Cork City?
I'll be honest with you, I spoke to a couple of people and Keith Flynn wouldn't have been hugely well known to a lot of people, let's say, working in legal circles. But then again, as we know, solicitors cover a lot of different areas.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Some people practice in family law, some people do conveyancing and all this kind of thing. So it's a big world. I mean, you know, they had an office in the Capel building
in Dublin. Yeah.
And you know how big that is. There's a huge number of offices in there.
And Lindsay Clark, well, she stood for Fine Gael. But was she well known around the city?
I can't say that she was hugely well known, but I mean, she was obviously seen as somebody who could contend for the seat in the local election in that ward in Cork City back in 2014. I mean, she was young, she was professional, well qualified. There was an interview in our sister paper, The Evening Echo, in advance of that election, and you know, she was saying that she was a working mother and that she appreciated the challenges that a lot of people had to face, saying all the right things, effectively. My understanding is that while she didn't poll particularly brilliantly in that election, it wasn't necessarily a reflection on her as a candidate, maybe more to do with the fact that I think there was 13 candidates going for 4 seats in that ward. And, you know, there's a lot of competition there, and maybe it wasn't a traditional party stronghold for
and had she any tradition, so to speak, in the party? I know it's the party of law and order, and that's fascinating that she decided to stand for Fine Gael given her subsequent crimes. But did she any tradition or family tradition, as a lot of people have, in that political party?
I really can't say really can't. I mean, you know, both individuals in this case, I mean, you know, their background, their family background, really well liked, very well respected, extremely popular, you know.
Upstanding was a word,
yep.
I think. Yeah, that was you. Okay, well, I'm talking to Noel Baker of the Irish Examiner, and it's in connection with Annette Kinahan started this conversation, whose son, Annette, the reason why you were so outraged when you read Noel's very, very detailed two-page article in this morning's Examiner was because your own son was homeless.
Yes, my son was homeless through his addiction, unfortunately, he was homeless. And, like, I could not believe that all this was done on the backs of homeless people, the most vulnerable in society. Mm-hmm. You know, I am a mother of three. My son was my middle child. He was not an accident. He was a planned pregnancy. Mm-hmm. When I looked at my son when he was born, did I want him to be a drug addict? I had my husband and I both had different wishes for him, for his life, than to be dead on a toilet floor for 5.5 hours before he was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you're looking, and all those people that are out there sitting on the street are sleeping in tents, they're somebody's loved one.
Yeah.
You know, this is the thing that people don't see when they look and they think, oh, drugs and alcoholism, and that's where it got them and all the rest of it. They don't know the stories behind. They don't know the families behind. They don't know the pain and the anguish behind each child. That they're somebody's child, regardless of what age they are.
And they don't know the worth of each child. Oh, Clark and Flynn knew the worth of each homeless person. They paid them 100 quid for their PPS number.
Imagine, it, like, from what I read, there was 10 people, so that was €1,000. it cost them to buy those PPS numbers, and look at the money and the devastation that they've created.
Well,
from
as
that.
I say, Flynn is now the chef in a prison officer's canteen. Fair play to him, and she got two years. I want to bring, Katrina Toomey back in, back on this homeless, this awful element of, well, there's a lot of awful elements of these two, Flynn and Clark. Katrina, I've no idea how they would even have the neck to approach people and say, can I buy your PPS number?
Yeah, it's something that, you know, it's just a really bad crime, and the fact that it was planned the way it was planned, and that they've come out to say that it was purely for personal gain. They had no thought to anybody, especially those that are vulnerable. Can you imagine coming, one of them being brave enough to come along and to ask, can I buy your PPS number? They knew what they were doing. That was calculated. Mm-hmm. They were offering 100 euros to somebody that would use this probably for maybe drugs or maybe alcohol.
Well, Katrina, what I'm wondering, because it happened before, when you're approached, say, by a person on their own to commission a crime, it's very different to being approached by a couple. A man and a woman come up to you. You don't immediately suspect nefarious intent.
No.
When the man and the woman come up, and she might start and he might join in, and then they say, how are you doing? And do you need money for a hostel? And how much do you need? 100. Actually, that's or 20. Well, here's 50 or maybe 100. By the way, would you do us a little favour? She says it and they have a patter between the two of them. We just need a PPS number because I'm just back from England. It's when you have two people doing a sting, doing a crime like that, it becomes much easier.
It does. And it was a very clever scam, the way they executed it. And to think like that they knew what they were going to do with it. And again, it was for their own gain. So can you imagine the thought, the planning? I mean, you're talking about a husband and wife sitting down planning this. They're not even two people that aren't related, their husband and wife. So they knew what they were doing. They were struck off before. Obviously they were struck off for a very, very good reason, which is probably...
It's now 2021.
Exactly.
The four suspicions, apparently, to the Law Society were back in 2016 about different issues, in fairness. Mm-hmm. So that's what Noel is pointing out. Francis is in County Meath. We're talking about this jaw-dropping case of Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark, husband and wife, two solicitors in Cork, and basically set about, they stole identity, stole ID cards, manufactured false identities, false bills, set up numerous bank accounts, 80 fake bank accounts, borrowed money on those accounts, and then in a lot of cases disappeared and couldn't be found because a lot of the identities and details were false. And it was one incredible individual in the Bank of Ireland and the Gardaí, of course, Alan McCarthy, another Garda Alan McCarthy, and then it was an Alan, the McVoy called Alan Boland, who spotted this, and the other banks seemed to say, we'll write it off. Francis, you're listening.
I am, Joe, and I'm fuming. I am fuming since looking at the news last night.
Yeah.
I can't believe the brazen, the walking down the street sneering, laughing, not a bother on them, no shame. I want to know, can anybody else help me here? What happened to the word shame?
Shame.
I would look at the news and I would see the fellas coming here at the courts, and they would have hoods up, and I'd say, but they shouldn't be allowed to have them hoods up. No, there's no hoods up, and they just walk down the street, not a bother on them.
Now, apparently, that footage you're talking about is the footage of himself in his casual short and his jeans.
Yeah.
It looks like the two of them are out for a walk in the park. Maybe they thought they were going for a walk. But apparently that's not from yesterday. That's from a few months ago.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
But they were going into court, rambling into court.
You and I would die the shame of it. So I want to know what happened to the word shame. Why is nobody ashamed anymore? Look, the person that was representing the two of them said they saved the state an enormous amount of money by entering a guilty plea and avoiding a trial. Mm-hmm. Then she went on to say that her client had a history of depression. Can you get me somebody out there that doesn't have depression? You don't get a medal for depression. She lost her father when she was 20 and her mother died. So what? We all lost our fathers and mothers. We didn't go out to rob. And those poor homeless people, shame, shame on them. And 2 years is not enough.
Okay.
It is not enough. I'm absolutely, my friends and I are fuming. Yeah, there's no justice. There's just no justice. Okay. They'll come out now and they'll get a film part. They'll want their story told. Oh, it's maddening. What is wrong with our government that they allow this to happen?
Our
beautiful country has become crime.
Okay, but I think you've hit the nail on the head. The photograph, I think it's from October, the two of them swaggering up to court in a casual shirt, two casual outfits,
yeah.
And given the seriousness of what they were accused of.
That is the very thing that triggered her in me, made me mad.
Okay.
The sneering.
Okay, stay with us. Francis, Noel Baker's staying with us. We're talking about this incredible case. And as I say, there's an incredible article in today's Irish Examiner. I think it's free online, which is very unusual these days.
Oh, I get it in the local shop.
Yeah, well, it's in the Examiner and it's two pages. And if your jaw is hitting the floor, Francis, when you watch the TV news and listen to this, you may stand upstairs and let your jaw roll down the stairs when you read this article, because it's going to drop even lower. They are evil, evil, evil people.
They are. And
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We were talking about the court case yesterday. Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark, solicitors, husband and wife, they were sentenced to 4 years and 2 years, respectively, in prison for running an identity factory and robbing the banks of €400,000. They had 80 fake accounts, 60 false IDs. They had numerous SIM cards. They were manufacturing utility bills from Virgin Media, Airtricity, Electric Ireland, and were just on the rampage. And they were paying members of the homeless community. They were buying their PPS numbers in order to use them in their criminal activity. The judge, and we won't go into some details that were published in previous court appearances by these two, but the judge didn't spare his criticism of the likes of AIB. He praised Bank of Ireland and Alan Boland specifically, but he didn't spare his criticism of the other banks, and then the revelation that the banks, because of, what do you think, GDPR in Ireland, they can't share a fraud database. But one, the criticism of the other financial institutions, and two, the fraud database, Noel.
Yeah, well, as you mentioned there, in a previous court sitting, he'd been quite scathing of AIB. Now, I understand from my colleague Liam Heelan, who has chapter and verse on all this in relation to what was said in court, that AIB were in court yesterday as well. I get the point about the fraud database is, I guess, quite important because, as I mentioned in the piece, this has been something that's been on the agenda for the banking sector for quite a while, and the CEO of Bank of Ireland would have had an op-ed in the Irish Times last December
saying
we need this, and this is why we need it. And I don't know that necessarily GDPR is the issue, to be fair, but I think there are data protection considerations. The UK has one of these things, so I mean, it's a crude analogy, but I guess if you're in a town and you're working the door and there's a troublesome mob trying to get in and you eject them, well, then you get on the WhatsApp group and you inform everybody else that, you know, you might want to keep an eye out for whoever might be knocking on the door because we've already ejected them from here. And I'm assuming that's still legal. Mm-hmm. And I guess the banking or financial equivalent of that would be, look, if there's somebody here who is either very strongly suspected of it and there's hard evidence to that end, or maybe just in case of possibly a conviction, I don't know whether you'd even have to go that far, possibly, all the institutions should be privy to that knowledge. And let's say Bank of Ireland in this case could maybe have an entitlement to submit that information into a centralised database so everybody would be able to twig it. But in the UK, I think they have different legislation that was already there, so they had kind of front-loaded legislation that allowed for this database to be put in place. And my understanding, and I'm no legal genius, is that we aren't in the same space, and we would probably have to put in a certain amount of legislation before you could then actually implement the database, and that the data safeguards that people aren't unfairly maligned, or you know that they're not profiled in a way where it might impact on their ability to get credit or a loan or whatever, you know.
I take that point, but you would not be publishing the information.
You're
saying that Alan Boland in the Bank of Ireland fraud unit, he couldn't contact someone in AIB, his counterpart, or Permanent TSB, or the credit unions, and say, listen, as you know, and this is, I'm throwing out some names here, we have suspicious activity, without maligning the person or publishing any details or contacting the person. Does this ring a bell? There's no facility for that.
That's my understanding, yeah, absolutely. And this is why the Banking Payments Federation and others would be saying, we really would like this to happen.
The banks and the credit unions seem to be treating these guys, these two, as though they didn't know who they were. They were all numerous false identities. They were treating these loans as, well, hang on, they made an effort, they paid one or two, and it's put them into the bad debt box and we'll see what happens. But they weren't treating them as fraud. The Bank of Ireland were the only one who spotted it.
Yeah, and again, that's due to the diligence, I guess, and the legwork of the person in Bank of Ireland. And as I mentioned earlier on, because some element of repayment had been made, look, you know, I mean, if you go to the district court any week, there's people who get into financial difficulty, you know,
and
credit unions and other financial institutions are kind of trying to bring them in to recoup what they can. I guess if you had this database, it would allow for the dissemination of that information, and it might make a difference in certain ways, but, you know, you I guess you have to get your ducks in a row to make sure that you can do this in a way where people's civil rights and entitlements aren't trampled on either.
Yeah, let me bring in Martin quickly. Joe at RT.ie. We're talking about the case of Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark. They're solicitors. Well, struck off solicitors now. They're criminals. They're criminals. Evil criminals. From Cork. They were two solicitors. They got married. We don't know whether they agreed to collude before they got married or the life of crime began after they got married. But they basically robbed banks. 400,000. They set up false identities, nearly 80 false bank accounts, 60 false bills, loads of bills, identities, bought PPS numbers off homeless people, believe it or not, for a lousy 100 quid, to buy someone's identity, the two of them. And they got, Flynn got 4 years yesterday, but he's, as we speak, he's preparing dinner for prison officers in, I presume he's in Cork, and she got 2 years in the Doca Centre, I presume, or Limerick, whatever, women's prison she's been sent to. Martin, quickly, you're listening.
Oh, yeah, Joe.
Yeah, your point, please.
I was just thinking back to the Polish fisherman, remember a number of years ago, that imported the garlic.
Yeah.
Remember that? And all the
public
forward over and the prison sentence he got. And here we have these two that have been in trouble before, and they're getting just allowed these maybe 2 or 4 years sentencing. Sentence should be at least minimum 10 years. Like all the trouble they went to deceive people and keep them under the radar for as long as they could. The way I look at white-collar crime in this country and a lot of countries, because it's white-collar crime, the sentences are low. If that was an Arnie Joe soap in the street that pulled the scam, you'd get a heftier sentence.
Well, in fairness to the judge, he seemed to be really on top of this case in terms of his knowledge and the information he was collating from the bench. He said in Flynn's case, the maximum sentence, I think, Noel, you can help me, was 8 years, and in both cases, so, but he had mitigating circumstances in both cases. So Flynn was down to 4, which means he'll be out. Will he be out in less than 2? Because he's been in custody for a few months. And Clark got 2, which means she'll be out. What's it now? January. She'll be out for this time next year, basically.
Yeah, but
she'll miss. She might even get out for Christmas at this.
Yeah, but
at this rate.
What does he mean by, you know, the circumstances? Like,
you see, in fairness now, Martin, and I wasn't there and you weren't there, the judge hears everything and sees everything. You know what I mean, in fairness. But I take your point. People would be upset, saying, I think people are more upset about the the evil of these two, buying PPS numbers from homeless people, setting up so many accounts, being so brazen doing it together and obviously covering each other's backs, which makes the crime much, much more difficult to detect.
Why then are we not allowed to see, the general public, to have the full facts so we can make a fully informed judgment on what went on?
Okay.
What's the point?
I take that. That's a question, and let that question sit. Thanks indeed, Martin. Noel, were you in court?
No, I wasn't in court. My colleague Liam Heelan has been at all the court.
And who you credit at the end. But this photograph and the image on the news last night of the two of them, this is what seemed to have really, and understandably, upset. It's one element that upset so many people. The swagger was last October when the two of them strolled up to court. Now she was carrying a mask in her hand. He was wearing... Now, you're not obliged to wear a jacket into court. You're not obliged to wear anything into court, so to speak. But the two of them looked like in October that they were going for a stroll in Fitzgerald Park.
Yeah, I mean, I think one has to look at this maybe in relation to how the investigation unfolded. I think it was apparent at an early stage that the Gardaí had done an incredibly comprehensive job here, and that they had an extremely strong case against them, mm-hmm. and a mountain of evidence. And as one of your colleagues mentioned earlier on, and Liam would have mentioned this in his court reports as well, in mitigation, it would have been said that they could have put the state to a lot more expense if they had entered a different plea, maybe contested some elements of this, and you would have had to go down the route of a big, long trial. Because such was the level of... the number, let's say, of infractions here and crimes and the level of detail and everything that went into it, it would have gone on for quite some time, I'm sure. And maybe it's just a case that they kind of said, well, look, we know where this is going, you know? I mean, they're both qualified solicitors. I'm sure they have a very good idea as to the balance of probabilities and all this kind of thing. And they probably looked at it and said, well, look, okay, right. Mm. And my understanding is that they were very cooperative as well as soon as the Garda attention honed in on them, and they were aware of it.
And remember, I think you point this out in the article as well, that when the Gardaí are investigating this and they say, hang on a minute, I'm trying to imagine their case conference. Okay, there's suspicions about him or her. And then someone says, do you think the two of them are in it together? Do you think the two of them are up to their neck in it together, which is unusual? And then someone says, that's unthinkable. And then it becomes a reality that the two of them are doing it together. They were colluding. They were partners in crime.
Yeah, well, absolutely, because, I mean, we know that from basically what the court has heard and also some background information as well. I don't think it was ever a case really where, and I'm only speaking here from what I know of it, that one person kind of said, listen, it was primarily me, you know. I think it very much seems like kind of a joint enterprise entered into jointly and carried out jointly, you know. And any differences... In the sentences that were handed down, I think the judge referred to particular circumstances or whatever, you know. But that was it, you know. And one of the curious elements of this is that they actually both qualified, albeit a number of years apart, from the University of London, which might seem a little bit peculiar for two people born and raised in Cork City. But, you know, they seem to have effectively gone down this road together.
And Noel, any statement from Fine Gael or any previous the involvement of the different organisations that they were involved in before? Now, not today, they were culpable. They were probably duped by them as well. But
no, to be frank with you, and I mean, a lot of the people that I spoke to would have been hugely respective of, as I mentioned before, their families and their backgrounds, and you know, and I guess you also, I know people are kind of looking at her tilted election in the local elections in 2014. Yeah. But back in 2014, you know, there was nothing that anybody is aware of to suggest that there was anything untoward going on. And, you know, a lot of people get nominated to run for election and they give it a go and it doesn't work out and then they just drop out and that's the end of that, you know. And in this case, it seems to have been that, you know, there was some suggestion, I think, maybe after they were struck off, if I remember correctly, that she may have been considered around that time for the subsequent general election. But I think that might actually be wide of the mark, that
Okay. No comment from either of their families.
To be honest with you, I think there was sufficient information there in relation to what they were doing and how they were doing it without approaching them.
Okay, so we know the family's absolutely nothing to do with it, but it's an awful, awful evil thing what they did. Well, what do you... I am going to put you into a corner here. One, I'm baffled, Noel, about that spelling mistake that Alan Boland spotted. What was it, an address or the name of a company? Or
I can't tell you because
okay,
I don't know.
But Alan Boland saw these applications, different applications. There was no connection between them because they're all different people. And he noticed, for argument's sake, you don't know what I don't know, but I'm trying to work out the genius of this man, Alan Boland. He said, hang on a minute, how come they spelled, I don't know, electricity with two E's rather than one E, and it's spelled the same way across. And he said, hang on a minute, that's a bit suspicious. And that, he was gone after them. He was down the rabbit hole after them because of that, and he did CCTV and ATMs, and it's an incredible piece of work. And as Judge O'Donovan said, without this man, these two would never have been caught, even though they come to the attention of the Law Society beforehand. And then the incredible work of the Gardaí and your own incredible work on collating this into a jaw-dropping, unputdownable two-page article in today's Irish Examiner, Noel. And I know you're not into awards, but I do hope somebody nominates you for a journalism award, because you've done some service and given these two the publicity. And I presume Prime Time or someone else is going to do a documentary on them to expose what they're up to. But I'm sure he's full of remorse as he cooks the dinners in the prison officer's canteen. And I'm sure Lindsay Clark is as well. Noel Baker, social affairs correspondent of the Irish Examiner, Gurumila Mockett. Annette Kinhan, I'm very conscious you were our first call. I'm very conscious what propelled you to call a family tragedy, your son homeless and then dying, and your anger about these two using homeless people for their bank robberies. But it's horrific.
Joe, okay. You know, much has been made of the families of these two, but we have to remember homeless people have families as well. Homeless people, families grieve for their loved ones found on the streets, dead in tents and in sleeping bags. They grieve for the children that have no homes, that don't have a wardrobe to hang up their clothes in. I mean, there's so much grief and distress around homelessness that is just brushed under the carpet. Even to go back to that programme RTE ran there a while ago, and they gave an insight into homelessness, or they look at the toy show, the money that they raised for sick children, which was brilliant. But nobody seems to do that for the homeless, because they're marginalised, forgotten about, and they're just disposable people.
And on the money, Noel, what do they do with the money?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and I suppose it's fair to say nobody knows.
Gone or is it hidden?
Well, one can only assume it's gone, because, you know, from speaking to people familiar with the case, there's no hint that there's anywhere else, you know? I mean, like, obviously people familiar with them would speculate, and it is speculation, to be fair, that it's, you know, one person said there's no way that there wasn't a contingency plan. There's no way that you have that amount of money in a safe, and that's it. That's the sum total.
They had 100 grand in their safe.
Well, yeah, it's just over 92, I think.
Okay,
yeah. But,
well done,
but to be fair, though, you know, it's the kind of case that leads you towards speculation, but there's nothing to suggest that there actually is anything anywhere else. And, you know, there would have been outgoings, and obviously there was a couple of properties being rented and things like that, you know. So it's impossible to know, and I think only they can answer that question. But just to go back to what your previous contributor was mentioning if we can give ourselves a mention here, because on that very issue about homelessness, you know, just 2 weeks ago, myself and two of my colleagues profiled some of the people who've passed away known to homeless services in the last year. And, you know, they are real people, and they're very, very real tragedies. And I suppose in this case, there's so much to focus on and there's so much to look at. But the element of the PPS numbers coming from people who are in a deeply vulnerable position themselves, you know, I do think it's worth people recalling that.
Yeah. They preyed. They preyed on homeless people, and as I think it was Annette or was it Katrina said earlier, they weren't. They weren't impoverished. They were. They were not impoverished. But there's, of course, to suggest that they hid the hundreds of houses somewhere else, Noel, that would mean that would suggest that they're criminals. Oh, they are. I forgot.
Well. I mean, the court has ruled on that.
No. That is not okay. Okay. Noel Baker, again, well done, and the all the staff in the great newspaper, The Examiner, and giving this the coverage it deserves for all those different elements. Annette Kinahan, thinking of you again, Annette, and your dear boy, Katrina Toomey. I'm just thinking, Katrina, they robbed 400 grand from the banks. How many penny dinners could you buy for that in the wonderful work you do? Anyway, thank Katrina, you. Thanks, Neil. Katrina Toomey from Cork Penny Dinners. joe@rte.ie.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
We were talking about Priscilla Presley yesterday, but it's a different Priscilla. Priscilla Granger. Priscilla, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. I'm really worried now about that phone line as I hear it disintegrating before my very ears. Priscilla, but you have something to celebrate, and it's about your wonderful mother, Anne.
Well, today, for the first time in over 9 months, I get to give a hug to my mum.
Okay, tell us how this has come about.
Unfortunately, Mum became very ill last March. Mm-hmm. And she went into the wonderful care in Fairview Community Hospital. And They were just wonderful. But unfortunately, we had to get long-term residential care for her because she became disabled. She lost her muscles in her hands, her feet and her legs.
Oh, God. Okay.
And unfortunately, we couldn't get carers to do full-time private work. And I and my daughter, Amy, we just weren't able to look after her and give her the quality of life she deserves. So we chose the decision with permission, and we admitted her into the Four Ferns Nursing Home in Fox Rock.
Okay.
And it was heartbreaking, Joe, because it was the first time ever that Mum and Amy and I were ever separated. Okay. We've been together a long, long number of years. And Mum has been our rock because we've gone through our own fair share of trouble.
Right.
But anyhow, we made it in the best interest of Mum, and she basically checked in to the Four Ferns. And let me tell you, my mother, Anne Granger, is now walking today.
Great.
And I want to thank all her consultants, both in the matter private, Vincent, everywhere Mum was. The only place that she says herself she wasn't was the rotunda.
She hasn't
made it there yet.
Okay.
And she is just one woman. Herself and my late dad were in the pub trade all their lives. She worked so hard. So I made the decision, even though it's very, very expensive, she deserved it. So she has been rambling around and she's doing extremely well. So I said to my daughter on Sunday, I said, you know what we'll do? I said, we'll bring out the two dogs who are her dogs to see her.
Okay.
And that's when the video, and you know, I didn't send in the video to Liveline. I sent it in to thank you guys because everybody can give out and say, you know, oh, this and that and frontline staff. And, you know, you are the people that have got the likes of my mum and kept them alive because all they have is their radio.
Yeah.
They have their television at night time, but they don't want to be watching Dr. Phil and all these programs, so it's radio in the afternoon, the listening.
Okay.
So she has remarkably done so well, and please God that in another couple of weeks we will be able to give her a kiss. Amy, my daughter, hasn't been able to give her the hug because she's working. Christmas Day was probably the hardest part because we met in the Four Ferns are just amazing. They have a, what you would call a little barn, a shed.
Okay.
And it's decorated in like a sitting room.
Right.
And we went down, but I walked in and the wheels are in. And obviously there was a lot of tears. And I said, God, this is different, ma'am, isn't it? And she says, it certainly is, because you were seeing each other.
Okay, we'll just describe, just while we try and improve that line, Priscilla, I'll just describe this pod. What Four Ferns did was, they have an underground car park, and they put in a big barnish shed with heaters and decorated it like a sitting room. They put up a screen inside, obviously the Perspex screen, with microphones and an intercom so they could talk. Now, what did your mother think when she came into this unit? What did she describe it as, Priscilla?
Well, I know what it's like to be on death row now.
She does. But that was an ingenious idea, given the restrictions, to try
Absolutely.
And people to see each other a little bit more comfortably, because anyone who's done a window visit in a nursing home, especially in the winter, and the low sun and the various things, it can be very, very distressing trying to shout through a closed window. So they set up this unit in the underground car park and put in all the PPE and all the protection gear.
And even today, like, I have PPE sitting with my gloves on, like my mask on, but it's just a completely different visit, because standing at a window, you're cold, the wind is whereas this idea was just, and it didn't cost a huge amount of money.
And you could hear, the thing is, you could hear your mother, couldn't you?
That's right.
Yeah, you see, that's...
Like, you know, and there's a microphone and an intercom.
You see, and that's the thing, older people, like, their hearing goes, their sight gets a bit weaker. So you need, it doesn't work on a phone. It doesn't work on a phone.
No.
Now, Priscilla, the audio, the what you sent us in is what, the two doggies, that's Holly and Bobby.
Yes.
Two Yorkshire. Is the audio of the two of them seeing their...
The two of them seeing my mum. They haven't seen her since last year.
Oh, God. Okay.
And then my daughter Amy brought in an iPad, but we didn't have a clue how to look into the iPad. Her mum would be ringing. And, like, you know, mum, as she said herself, I'm more times hung up than I did anything
else. So just to introduce this piece, this is Holly and Bobby meeting Anne after 9 months, who they love. Oh, my God. And your mother's saying to them, who is it? And they're obviously running around the place with excitement.
Yeah, and they're up at the window. And as Mum said, they're like, the Lord left them like Sonny knows, because they're at the window trying to get in at her.
Anne, let me go to Anne Granger.
Hello, Joe.
How are you? How are you keeping? How are you keeping, Anne?
Oh, I'm keeping great, Joe.
Okay.
Wonderful.
What was
Thank
it like?
God.
What was it like seeing Holly and Bobby after 9 months?
Oh, it was fantastic. They nearly went crazy. They nearly broke down the window. So they did with their paws.
Trying to get in at you.
Trying to get in at me. It was wonderful. But I must say that the Four Ferns have fantastic what they've done with the Barna Shed.
The Barna Shed.
And that Priscilla can come in one side and I can go in the other. And for all visitors, it's absolutely fantastic to get a half an hour visit and be able to look at them and talk to them.
Yeah, and hear each other, Anne.
And hear each other, Oh, definitely. It makes a big difference, Joe.
And how long have you got Holly and Bobby, by the way?
Oh, Holly is about 9 years old, and Bobby is about 4, and then there's two others as well.
Oh, is there?
Bella. Yeah, oh, there's Bella as well, and Alfie.
Alfie. Okay. Yeah. Now, and what's it been like for you? First of all, did you get vaccinated? You did?
I got the first one because when they had the first one here, I was in the matter private for a week.
Okay.
So I'll be getting the other one in about 2 weeks. But everybody here, nearly everybody has got the second vaccination,
so
which is wonderful.
But you got the first one and you're waiting on the second one
and then mop up.
Yeah, they come back and do it. And what was it like getting the vaccination?
Oh, nothing at all, just an ordinary injection. Now, the only thing was I felt tired after it and sleeping. But, of course, when I said that to my daughter, Priscilla, she said, "Mammy, you're always great at sleeping. You don't know if you have any reactions to it."
Great. And what's it been like in the nursing home for the last 9 months?
Well, I'll tell you, before the lockdown, Joe, it was fantastic. We had music 2 days a week.
Yeah.
fantastic guy who comes in, Benny, and plays, and a great sing-song. And then we have an exercise class with Mia. And they used to take us out for walks all around that. And we'd have quizzes as well. But now, on account of the lockdown, unfortunately, we don't have that at the moment. But we'll look forward to having it, please God.
And people forget. The lockdown in a nursing home, it means they can't bring people in from outside, such as musicians, hairdressers, dancing classes. It's been so hard on people. So hard.
Is.
And how did you manage? How did you manage, Anne?
Oh, well, I just, every day I get two papers, Joe, and I read them.
Good woman.
And then I listen to you from a quarter to two.
Great. That's
In the evening time, I turn on the television. But now, since I'm walking, I go out, they take me out twice a day with a walking aid.
Yeah.
And I walk down the corridor and then walk back other times. So that's a good exercise for me, and to spend some time doing that.
Yeah. But
I never found it boring or anything like that, Joe.
But it sounds to me like you're a very grateful person, Anne. You're grateful that you're not coursing the darkness. You're praising the light.
No, I'm not. And I, even when the stretch in the evenings came, I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. Every evening I was looking out and I say, don't pull the heavy curtains yet, it's too early.
Well done. But you could hear the wrench in Priscilla's voice when you ended up going into the nursing home. That was tough on them. That was tough on your family.
It was. It was very tough, Joe. But you see, I couldn't. I just lost the power of my legs overnight.
Right.
And my fingers all turned into my hands. So what I do now with my hands, I wear rollers, paint rollers, to keep my fingers from turning in.
Okay. This is the roller that we'd use to paint the wall.
Yeah, that's what it is, Joe.
And what, you rest your hands on them?
No, I push it in to pull the fingers out from the palm of my hand.
Wow. And is that painful, Anne?
It is when you're doing it, to pull them out, it is painful. You know, but it's only for a few minutes, and then it's okay when you get them in.
Well done. Well done, and you're... That's incredible. Holly and Bobby, they're back at home.
They're back at home, Joe. I hope when all this is lifted, I'll be able to go home and see them.
Yeah, of course you will. But you've heard of dogs, Anne, that haven't seen their owners for months and get overexcited.
Oh, yeah. Well, they did on Sunday when they came. But they settled down after a few minutes then.
Okay. Up to their own development. And I hope things improve dramatically very soon with the vaccinations and the world. Because in the UK, I know we can't keep bringing up the UK, but from next week in the UK, they're going to allow one person per week in PPE to go into the nursing home and to see...
That's right. I've seen that on the television last night.
Yeah. Okay, and say hello to everyone in the nursing home and all the staff as well.
I know you think they're fantastic. Everybody here.
Great,
Joe.
And you're fantastic, Anne Granger. Well done, Priscilla.
Lovely talking to you.
Likewise, Anne. Bye-bye. Behind yourself. And Priscilla, you mind those dogs?
I sure will. And if you want to do dog sitting sometime, Joe, you're very welcome to come up and pick them up for a month.
And don't let anything happen to those dogs. Oh God.
Oh no.
Oh, Priscilla, your life wouldn't be worth living. Your life. Anyway, Priscilla, I'm glad things are moving along.
It's the place, but they have been amazing, and thanks to the staff here and everything, but it has been difficult. It's that we get through it. You have to battle it. You pick up you pick up their socks and you say, let's go and let's run with it, and we're going to make sure. And our big dream now is to get to Lanzarote when this is all over.
Oh, great.
So, by God, Lanzarote are a cruise.
Oh,
so
why would you
whichever.
Be? And Priscilla, how have you managed during the pandemic?
Ah, Joan, listen, it's been heartbreaking, to be honest with you, because it's terrible. My daughter and I, it was heartbreaking for the first month, but we have a small guest house on the Malvern Road.
Oh, very good.
So it's long-term accommodation. So we were kept busy, thank God.
Okay.
We were able to pay the mortgage and keep the roof over our head.
Well done, well done. Okay, Priscilla Granger and Anne Granger, best of luck to both of you. Let's go back to Lindsay Clark and Keith Flynn. John Kelly is contact. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
You came across. People are very reluctant to talk about this. These two, especially given that they were sent to prison and the whole thing about preying on homeless people. John, you, how did you come across Lindsay Clark?
I actually came across her back in 2000.
Okay. Let me take a quick ad break.
Okay.
Talk to Joe on 1850-715-815.
Okay, we're talking about Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark. The programme today began with a phone call from Annette Kinnivan. Annette was remarking on the point. These two were sent to prison yesterday for this incredible bank robberies they were involved in. Two solicitors, husband and wife, two relatively young people as well. And Annette was really upset about the fact that they preyed on homeless people and bought their PPS numbers to begin setting up fraudulent bank accounts, etc., etc. Keith Flynn and Lindsay Clark. Now, Lindsay Clark is still on LinkedIn, which is where John Kelly's testimony is, and she's still on LinkedIn as a solicitor. John, when did you write this testimony about Lindsay being so brilliant?
I'd say it would be back in 2014, Joe.
Okay, and how did you come across her?
I think it was a friend mentioned her. I was having problems with my divorce.
Okay.
And I had a few issues that I couldn't resolve, and I got Lindsay's number, and I gave her a ring, and that's mm-hmm. how I met her the first day.
And how did you get on?
Brilliant. I met her the first day, explained my situation to her. I gave her all the papers. I had one meeting initially with her. Then she dealt with me by phone afterwards. I had another meeting. In the space of 2 to 3 months, she sorted the whole issue out for me.
Okay.
Now, she would ring me after 6 in the evening. She certainly went above and beyond. She didn't give up. Like, I had an issue with some particular aspect of the divorce, but she went off and she got advice, and I was really impressed with her service.
Okay, and you say, did she ask you to write this recommendation?
No. I was so impressed because, I've had experience as solicitors all down through the year.
So you say Lindsay Clark would be the first solicitor I would go to in the morning for advice if I had a problem or legal issue, and no hesitation in recommending her to anyone. This is on LinkedIn, where she's still up as a solicitor. When you heard that that herself and her husband, did you meet Keith Flynn, by the way?
I met Keith Flynn, but I didn't know they were married at the time. I met Keith in the office one day, all right.
And how did he come across? Same.
Nice affable chap. Affable, nice chap.
And was it a busy office, Flynn, Keith Flynn solicitors?
Well, when I went in there was about one or two other people in the office the day I went in. No, it wasn't like there was no people running in and out, right?
But they had employees. Okay. And so you dealt with Lindsay Clark, and did she tell you anything of her own background, that she's from Cork, her mother was a well known poet, and did you know anything about her?
No, I didn't really know anything about her. I knew she had a daughter because she remarked on that, because I had two kids myself.
Okay.
And we just remarked that she had a daughter. That was all.
Okay. And when you heard, I don't know whether you've seen today's Examiner, for example.
I haven't seen today's Examiner, but when I heard it the first day, I was actually more than surprised. I was absolutely shocked. I didn't think, really shocked, to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. Surprised. And the fact that the two of them were up to their neck in it, and that they were buying identities off
people. Yeah.
You wouldn't have thought, if you didn't, obviously, you wouldn't have thought of that she was capable of such a crime.
Not in a million years.
Yeah.
Not in a million years. That she came across as a very nice person, as a very affable person, as a person that was very professional, and she was came across as being caring and kind as well.
And did you know she stood for Fine Gael?
I read that somewhere afterwards.
Okay.
I read that somewhere afterwards. When I found out about what was happening, I read something in the internet about
You wouldn't have been aware of her around the city.
No, around Cork City. No, I'm not from the city. No.
Okay. Well, that's fascinating insight, John. It really is. And as you say, people at a distance are gobsmacked by the extent of the crime and the collusion between the two of them, and the using homeless people like that, and then what, 60 bank accounts, 60 false, loads of false IDs, credit cards.
That's a lot of work, isn't it?
That's an incredible amount of work. Yeah. Forging all those bills, Yeah. Okay, the PPS number was the only, as Noel Baker said, the only genuine springboard they have. But they used the PPS numbers, which they bought off homeless people, as their springboard into getting, opening accounts and getting loans. And then, so far, 300,000 missing. They found 100 grand in one of their apartments. Okay, John, you stay safe, John.
Okay,
and thanks indeed. That's John Kelly talking about Lindsay Clark. I presume LinkedIn have no control over the fact that Lindsay Clark is still up on their website as a qualified solicitor with genuine testimony from people, genuine people like John Kelly. I presume they've no supervision over that, though they should have. She's not a solicitor, she's a disgraced solicitor, and she's a criminal, and she's in prison.
Talk to Joe on 1850 715 815.
And Joe at rt.ie. D. Maher, D, good afternoon. Elvis, back to Elvis.
Good afternoon, Joe. Yes,
we're
indeed
searching for Elvis. Ireland's biggest, most devoted Elvis fan. We had Maurice Colgan on yesterday, who has incredible memorabilia.
Yes.
What's your claim to be his biggest fan, D?
Well, Joe, back in 1974, I had the pleasure of travelling over to Las Vegas and seeing 11 of Elvis's shows.
Wow.
In the Hilton Hotel. Yeah, absolutely amazing.
11?
Fantastic. Unbelievable. He was really brilliant. And outside of the Hilton, on the last night, I actually met him and I held his hand.
Wow.
Yeah, we had given some presents to his management and I spoke to him. I asked him, I said, "Hi, Elvis, we're from Ireland." I said, "Did you get the present we left for you?"
Yeah.
And he looked at me with those absolutely fabulous blue eyes. He said, "I sure did, honey, thank you." So that's a memory I'll carry forever, Joe.
And did you get a photograph, Dee?
Do you know, unfortunately, this is the worst thing ever.
The day before.
Do you know what? You know the time it was in it, and it was like four girls together.
Oh, you met him. The moment is the moment.
I met him. Yeah,
you don't
I met
need
him.
A photo. The moment is the moment. How many of his shows have you seen altogether when he was alive?
I've seen 27. I went back in 76 and I saw 15 in Las Vegas, yeah. And one at a place called Anaheim, California. And that time we brought him an Irish police badge because he collected a lot of badges.
Oh, that's
So he wasn't very well then, Joe. He was a sick man then.
He was
very keen to get this badge. One of his main guys, a guy called Joe Esposito, he set up a meeting, but unfortunately Elvis was too ill to meet us. But we got the badge to him. He kept asking his karate instructor, Ed Parker, every day, "Are the Irish girls still here?"
So
we got the badge to him, and I got a letter in return for that. Yeah.
Okay, 27 shows. Dennis Brennan in Dublin. Dennis, what's your claim to Elvis fame?
How are you, Joe? I have a very large selection of Elvis memorabilia, including LPs, EPs, 78.
How many LPs?
I have about 60 LPs and about 15 EPs, which would be the 45 singles.
Yeah.
A huge number of singles. I've got 78. I've got 178, actually, his master's voice. Never played. I was afraid to put it on the turntable. All Shook Up on one side, Hound Dog on the other side.
Yeah.
Got Elvis Monthly magazines from 1969 to 1977. Never missed a month.
And did you go and see Graceland or any of his shows?
Went to Graceland. Never got a chance to. I'm about the same age as yourself, Joe.
Yeah.
I was 18 when he passed away.
And do you remember when he died?
Yeah, I can remember. Yeah, it was. I think it was a Thursday evening. I remember I was playing a basketball match in Artane. Came home, and I got a phone call from one of my best pals, Sean O'Connell, who you would be familiar with there. He has the insurance shop in Fairview.
Yeah.
He rang me to say that Elvis had died. I was devastated. And I remember watching the news at 10, and Reginald Bosanquat, I think his name was.
Yeah, Bosanquat, yeah.
And there was a caption of Elvis. All you could see was Elvis's head over the slot machine because of Colonel Parker. It was every book counted, you know, as far as...
Okay, and your memorabilia is you have some leaves from Graceland.
I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg and Tony Prince, and he used to go over there every year to Graceland and bring back... And he used to give them out to charity and things like that, or auction them for charities. And when I was over in Graceland, I grabbed a bunch of leaves from Elvis's garden, and I still have them in it.
Well done.
I've newspapers from the week, you know, that Elvis died.
Okay.
I've also got a macabre. I've recordings of Jimmy Savile, you know, on the radio the day after the week of Elvis's death, and he was talking to people who were kind of
who wanted to die. People were, I remember that time. Okay, Dennis Brennan, Gurumila Mahaga, D. Marr, thanks indeed. Cara Harris on sound, Maeve Mooney's the BCO, Niamh Dunn is the researcher, and the series producer, Rebecca Meehan, produced today. Ray Darcy's next.